Good evening and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Gina Cervetti. Tonight, we present the first of three panel discussions presented by Boston University's African Studies Center and the African Presidential Archives and Research Center. The discussion, entitled Rebuilding Liberia, features Dr. Patrick Sion, former president of the University of Liberia, Dr. John Gay, who has written and studied extensively in Africa and lived and worked in Liberia in the 1960s, Dr. Joe Sullivan, the executive director of the Cambridge Public Schools Office of Curriculum Development and a former Peace Corps volunteer in Liberia, and Counselor Tiwan Ganglo, a Liberian human rights lawyer living in exile in the U.S. The discussion also features brief remarks from Her Excellency Ruth Sando Perry, former interim president of Liberia and current president in residence at the African Presidential Archives and Research Center. Introducing tonight's panelists is Dr. James Pritchett, associate director of the African Studies Center at Boston University. Dr. Pritchett.
For about 50 years, the African Studies Center has coordinated the undergraduate and graduate study of Africa at this university. Also, in some respects, we have been the interdisciplinary arena where anthropology, history, economics, political science, law, public health, art, literature, languages all come together to seriously engage the African continent. And we see ourselves as engaging it not just in ways that are theoretical and academic, but engaging it in ways that are also extremely pragmatic that have policy implications. In many respects, we see ourselves as an assembly of scholars that not only meet to talk to the general public, but an assembly that likes to invite the public to join us in the construction of useful knowledge about the African continent. Tonight is just one such exercise. This will be one of three engagements that will center around Liberia. We hope that these explorations will take us deep into the heart of the troubled history of Liberia, but we also hope that it will take us far into the future of what we hope will be a much better future. The fact that we have chosen this time, this moment, to focus on Liberia happened to be a fortuitous intersection of both opportunity and talent. We happen to have on our campus at this moment Her Excellency Ruth Sando Perry, former president of the Republic of Liberia and currently the Balfour President in Residence at the African Presidential Archives and Research Center. We also happen to have on our campus research fellow, past president of the University of Liberia, Dr. Patrick Sion. To not take advantage of this opportunity of having these two talents on our campus at the same time and to not invite you to join in the deliberations, we think would be a dereliction of our duty. So at this point, I think I will fade into the background and let those who know much more about the topic at hand take over, and I will turn the proceedings over to my colleague, Dr. Patrick Sion.
Your Excellency, Madam Ruth Perry, distinguished ladies and gentlemen, let me add my own word of greetings and welcome to the first of our series of three panels on Liberia. The first, Liberia, Building Liberia, Historical Background. The second, Building Liberia, Reinventing the State in Liberia. And the third, Building Liberia, an Agenda for Self-Sustainable Socio-Economic Development. Tonight is a very special night for Liberia, Africa's oldest republic, and its people. One of America's premier research centers on Africa, Boston University's African Studies Center, has organized a series of panels designed to undertake a critical analysis of Liberia's crisis. The analysis will look at what path Liberia took that brought it to where it is today, what historical, social, political, and economic forces maintained it on that path, and what lessons can be drawn from that experience. We have followed events unfold in Liberia through the mass media in the past 2.5 decades, starting in 1979. What has unfolded is neither pretty to the eyesight nor good to conscience. It brings to mind Robert Jordan's novel, Lord of Chaos. He writes, "The wheel of time turns, and ages come and pass, leaving memories that become legend. Legends fade to myth, and even myth is long forgotten when the age that gave it birth has come again. There are neither beginnings nor endings to the turning of the wheel of time, but it is a beginning." So many memories have been created in Liberia in the past 2 decades, and many are now legend. A people, some would argue, many peoples, forced together under a shed by the storm of history, lost their minds and damn near lost their souls. Mm. They committed unthinkable, unimaginable, and incomprehensible acts against each other. We gather here tonight believing that the end to the madness is finally at hand. We have assembled also tonight because with the end, there is going to be a beginning, a new beginning for Liberia, some will think. Accordingly, this series is called Building Liberia. We have a panel of distinguished scholars and human rights activists for our first presentation. John Gay, on my right. John lived and worked in Liberia in the 1960s and 70s. The wind of change was blowing over Liberia and Africa. The Cold War was in full swing. The ugly American appeared on the scene. He, though, was the beautiful American. He represented America's best in loving one's neighbor as oneself, in rendering service to the poor, instilling democratic values, and protecting the weak against the strong, whether a ruler or a powerful state. Chiawan Gunglo, to the right of John Gay. Pleading the case of the poor and wretched, demanding that justice is done, insisting that all are treated equally before the law, and that rule of law, not tyranny, prevails, carries heavy penalties. Chiawan, in challenging the powers that be over human rights abuses in Liberia, took his life in his hand and came close to losing it many times. Joe Sullivan, on my left, close to my heart. In the 60s, in the midst of an intense power struggle among nations, which threatened peace around the world, President John F. Kennedy of the United States launched a quiet revolution. It was the Peace Corps. It was not the norm in Africa, and more particularly in Liberia, to see a white person riding in the back of a pickup truck or carrying his or her luggage on the head or living in the village with no electricity or running water. Young, idealistic Americans went out to Africa and Asia to wage peace, not war, and they captured the hearts and minds of the people they came in touch with and lived among. Joe Sullivan was one of those, and she captured the hearts and minds of many Liberians. She is also a beautiful American. Ladies and gentlemen, the panelists.
Thank you. Very, very generous.
Now we'll revise the order, and we'll start with John Gay.
Oh, all right. What I want to talk about is what are some of the reasons why Liberia is in the mess that it's in right today? Let's be honest and say it's in a mess. Obviously, there's no single reason for this, but there are many, and I want to try to look at them and see if we can understand them. Liberia seemed a prosperous, healthy nation when we were first there in the 1960s. The economy was growing rapidly at the height of the open-door policy. There was a strong market for rubber and iron. There was a unification policy which was working. The few educated indigenous people that I knew were achieving power. There was little real strife. Things looked good. But the future was not going to be good, as we know. I think of the analogy of the wheat and the tares, which, as of biblical importance, the tares were weeds that grew up among the wheat, and at one point, I fear that in Liberia, they choked the wheat out to the point where the Liberia that we knew after 1980 was a Liberia that did not have a harvest, except for a harvest of shame. Now, there's no single reason for this, even though people did predict it, even as early as the 19th century. We hear from Alexander Crummell, who was in Liberia at the time, that this is not working. He finally left. We hear from William Lloyd Garrison and other people in the States who said that is a bad idea, what they're suggesting. And in some ways, Crummell and Garrison and others were proved righter than they wanted to believe. Now, I'm suggesting a number of the seeds of disaster, and that this is admittedly somewhat negative, because I think it's important to look at that side. There was, of course, also the positive, and there were wonderful things in Liberia. I lived there 15 years. I loved the place. I still love it. But I think we need to look at why it went wrong. Now, the first set of seeds of disaster were in the indigenous population, not that they were themselves ready to make it go wrong, but there were many reasons why they couldn't make it go right. Too much diversity, friction between and within groups, and a very difficult physical environment. In some parts of Africa, there has been an indigenous society that could pull it together and make a unified nation, a unified resistance against colonialism. I lived the last 25 years after Liberia in Lesotho, which is a classic case of real resistance. It was a country that pulled itself together, that actually defeated the British, got them out. Liberians, indigenous peoples were divided. There were too many different aspects of secret society groups, different micro-level political structures ranging from chieftaincies to stateless societies, physical separation, a small population, unnavigable rivers, difficult communications overland, lots of intergroup friction that we know about. There was slavery between groups. The Vai, for example, took many of the Kpela people. I lived among the Kpela, and I felt identified with them. They took them as slaves to Vai country. There was frequent inter-village and intra-village warfare. The village where I was most closely associated in the interior, Bantu Salongma on the St. Paul River, where I lived for 8 months, had been riven with wars internally going back, and the people were able to tell me each one of those wars that had happened. There was a struggle over very limited resources to the point where hunger and starvation were regular events. When a rice farm would not burn successfully, when people would come in and actually burn the rice kitchens of their neighbors in order to gain power. There was, in addition, conflict between the savanna Muslims and the forest animists, which was most notable in the early times along the Vai corridor coming down on the north border. And later on in the late 19th century, under Samore Toure, there was conflict. These conflicts were irreconcilable between groups. And the European traders, slavers, and others played people off against each other. The harsh environment, as I say, disease, debilitation, hunger, a tension between survival and death, and a recourse often to malevolent medicines and even magic made things very difficult for people to come together. Now, the 19th century settlement equally was a time where there was a serious problem of non-meeting between cultures. There were opportunities. Some of the more rural settlements, upriver settlements, coastal settlements, which could have been chances for opening, but they were somehow neglected and marginalized, particularly because they used the indigenous peoples on an unequal basis. Wards taken into families who were in effect slaves, outside wives, commodities used and exploited, and the forest commodities were taken without adequate compensation, often simply stolen, as trade did grow. So the economic and political strategies was one to, I think of the Southern African analogy, of circling the wagons, putting up the lager against the outside to protect themselves so that you had an isolation from the indigenous people, but at the same time there was an isolation growing with the outside world because the Liberians brought with them from the United States a technology, sailing ships, ways of growing crops, which were very soon outmoded and outdated. And so the nascent merchant shipping companies were soon useless by the latter third of the 19th century. What had looked like a viable economy began to fall down. And in order to survive, they took ill-conceived loans which they thought might help them revive their business ventures, but the business ventures were based on a technology and a mercantile system that was no longer going to work. So we have then an indigenous system which was exploited and used, and the coastal system which used them but which was unable to compete, leading to an attempt to create hegemony in the Gramscian sense, but without the power and the economic strength to back it up. And the result was adopting American political forms and structures without the substance to keep them going. Now, in the 20th century, this led to increased difficult relations between the settlers and the indigenous people. The Liberian polity expanded into the interior, not by relationships of mutual exchange, but by force. One story that has always stuck in my mind, which was told to me by a friend from Lofa County, who heard it from his ancestors, his parents, grandparents, about how the Liberians came into Kolahun and invited the local chiefs into a parley, into a meeting, closed the door and killed them. This was the kind of thing that was not designed to make friends. But these were believed from the interior. And they did see, however, that when kids were pawned, taken as workers in the homes of interior of village of Liberians in the capital city, they were exploited. One of your successors, Madam Perry, Wilton Sankawulo, has now written a novel in which he tells the story of one of those pawns in a Congo household and the exploitation of this boy. He's a wonderful writer, Sankawulo. So we have economic exploitation. This, at a macro level also, farmland lost to rubber plantations. The 1 million acres that Firestone took was rice-growing country. It could have been. It wasn't. Instead, it was turned over to a crop which has no economic benefit for the rural people except to be exploited and bought as laborers by chiefs who were paid money by Firestone to bring laborers in. Enforced contributions to presidential birthdays, which people hated, the high-level corruption and expatriation of what they did produce, manipulation of rice prices causing the rice riots in 1979, renegotiation of bad debts, acceptance of a dominant settler culture, in other words, promoting expensive Western schooling, which a few could get into, but not many. And those who got into it were accepted only on the margins. Some of you know the name of Harry Greaves. He's now one of the advisors to Chairman Bryant. I remember when he was at Cuttington in 1970, he wrote a story about two people. One was Flumo, and one was Jeremy Futurebright. And Flumo and Jeremy Futurebright both graduated from Cuttington University College, where we taught. They went to see the minister in Monrovia for jobs. Flumo was told to wait outside and see whether maybe there'd be a chance. Jeremy went to the office and said, "Jeremy, come in, my boy, come in. How's your father? How's everything going for you?" So Jeremy Futurebright had a very bright future. Flumo went back to the interior. This is the image that came up, and that story was a brilliant story. So these are the seeds of disaster. I think I've made it to my 3 minutes, so I turn it over.
When I was leaving to go to Liberia, my husband and I we had joined the Peace Corps. You'll know how old I am now, but it was 1968, and it was a terrible, terrible year. And we wanted to leave. We wanted to be somewhere working in the Peace Corps, but we didn't have a preference of where to go, a continent or a country, as some other people did. We were eager to leave this place, and we would have gone to the first place we were offered. So it could have been Peru or it could have been Sri Lanka, but it was Liberia, and I consider myself very, very, very fortunate. Those of you who know some Liberian history may be familiar with the phrase that's part of my title, the love of liberty. That is from the Liberian flag and the motto of Liberia, which the full text of which is, "The love of liberty brought us here." And because our first experience was in rural Liberia, it was always an ironic phrase, knowing the surface history of Liberia that was presented to Liberians at that time in the early 70s and to the world, and even today in some things that are written about Liberia. But it has a real, really strong touch of irony in terms of Liberia's actual history and what it means for many of the majority population in Liberia. And I want to state that more conceptually with a quote from Dr. Amos Sawyer, who is a political scientist and whom I met at the University of Liberia and who was also an interim president of Liberia in the very early 90s. And this is a quotation from his book, The Emergence of Autocracy in Liberia, Tragedy and Challenge. And he said, quote, "The idea of Liberia was flawed in conception, design, and implementation." The idea of Liberia was flawed in its conception and its design and implementation. And there were people right from the beginning, when Liberia was formed as a state, a national state in the 1820s and formally in 1847, people who in the United States who were very divided about the aspirations and about the decision to form an exile community of African Americans. So that's where many of us begin to learn our Liberian history. I'm going to highlight a few things. There's a lot in Liberian history that's interesting and relevant to our discussion, but I'm going to highlight a few things. And some of this will seem obvious to many people, but I think it's worth noting, given the media coverage in the last 2 decades, but especially and including up to last summer here in this country. I think it's important to remember that 90% of the people of Liberia are of African descent, people whose ancestors have lived in the area, some of them for hundreds, but many people for thousands of years. That is who the majority of Liberians are. Among African Liberians, there are at least 16 major ethnic groups. Some would say 20, some would say 27. Each with their own language, such as Pala, Bassa, Loma, Gio, Mano, Kru, Grebo, Kron. And these Liberians who are speakers of these languages are also, Liberia is a very small country. When I was writing my dissertation here with Professor Sarah Berry, if some of you go into graduate work and you're doing a dissertation, you fall in love with your data, and it takes a distant observer to say, you know, this is a really small part of a really small country. People don't really want to know that much about it. You have to take things out. So it is a small country, but that means that these different ethnic groups live side by side. They were neighbors. There were difficulties. There are, you know, histories that are peaceful and that are not so peaceful. But many Liberians are multilingual, speaking their own language, the languages of their neighbors on either side, and speak at least, and the Liberians that I know, speak at least two African languages, usually more, as well as English. And one of the things that I wanted to point out, because my interest in my research was on the southeastern coast, on what's called the Kru Coast, some of the coastal towns in the 1800s had as many as 10,000 to 20,000 people. So when these small groups of people came from the United States, settled by the American Colonization Society, they landed in communities within near distance of communities that had 10,000 to 20,000 people. They were, especially on the Kru Coast, communities that were built up because of the trade and the socioeconomic history in those areas. When African American settlers, sponsored by the Colonization Society, arrived in the 1820s and 1830s, and they began to establish a colony along the coast of what's now Liberia, many African leaders actually looked on them as another group in the area. There were competitive relationships with African neighbors over trade, over territory, over farm and agricultural land, and the settlers were another part of the mix. Some of the leaders of those African communities welcomed the trade. They were interested in working with the settlers or trading with them. But in the end, and in short order, people were not interested in being controlled or governed and resisted that control. My research on the Kru Coast showed that throughout the 19th century, the American settlers sought to divert trade through their own established ports. They sought to control the businesses and tax African businesses. In addition to that, African leaders, African individuals were not allowed to participate in the political process. In the early years of the mid-1800s, people were not interested in participating in the political process, but it's my experience that in the early 20th century, people were interested in that added to the conflict. In the 19th century, it was mostly over trade and economic issues. People did live side by side, however, and nearby, and many African families chose to send their children to live with African American families who they considered westernized and having access to resources, to English, to a lifestyle, and to control and power that would benefit their families. And people did, in many cases, send their own children to live with African-American families. In other cases, it was not so voluntary. But for many individuals and people whom I interviewed who were elderly in the 1970s, people in some cases were treated as servants, some as stepchildren, and others, you know, really as very hardworking laborers who were not considered or treated as any reasonable members of the family. That was some of the cultural context and economic context of these relationships. On the Kru Coast, well, actually, not only on the Kru Coast, but in the interior of western Liberia, among the Gola, and especially on the Kru Coast, African leaders fought against the settler control at various points during the 19th century. And that included, especially in the 1850s, the 1860s, and the 1890s, usually over trade and sometimes physical abuse by settlers. These communities, and this is one of the things I would like to mention, John used the expression friction, and there certainly was, but I think if one tries to look from the interior towards the coast, towards the communities on the coast and toward the actual Atlantic Ocean, I think you get a different perspective. I think to some extent, the portrayal of Liberia and Liberian history is also a fiction. At least in the Southeast, people did not have much control over people in that part of Liberia. The African communities were in control. They had more money. They had more power. They had more economic resources. And so I would say that there's also somewhat of a fiction about there were still attempts to control people. There was abuse. But I think that in many cases, people on the Kru Coast had the upper hand. And they had the upper hand because they had access to trade and money. People were traders on the Kru Coast. They were mariners. They worked on European ships. They had access to English. They had access to communication networks. They had access to weapons. And they were living in communities in Ghana, Cote d'Ivoire, Nigeria. They knew about European colonization. They knew where that led. And they had money and information that some other Liberians didn't have. So they did resist the settler control. It was also a surprise to me when I did do that research. I was quite well aware that in the teens, in 1915, 1916, when there was a massive resistance against Liberian government control, that the Liberians had called in the United States for help and that U.S. gunboats and soldiers were used to put down a revolt on the Kru Coast. But I did not know and discovered that in the 1850s, they also had American help. In the 1860s, in the area of around Sino and Greenville along the Kru Coast, when there was actually fighting and using weapons in gunfire against the settlers, that the United States did also help out the Liberian government when they were asked, and they did on a small scale, but it was enough to overcome the resistance. So those inherent contradictions are part of the Liberian state. They are part of the leadership. In spite of that resistance, when we look at the 20th century, the frame of reference for the government, the frame of reference for the minority that was leading Liberia never really did change. They resisted political participation. They continued to tax people in the interior. In the 20s and 30s, Liberian individuals and members of the government exploited African labor through forced labor to Fernando Po and locally. And these things continued throughout that period. And in the 1940s, with the election of William V.S. Tubman, he did broaden the participation of parts of Liberia in the interior, bringing them in to as second-class citizens. And others will talk more about that, I think. Things did not really change a lot. On the surface, they did. There was a lot of vocabulary and talk about unity from the 1940s to 1971, when he died. His vice president, William Talbert, took over and did make a lot of political statements and rhetoric to include more majority Liberians. And this raised expectations. And this also followed independence movements throughout the continent, the anti-apartheid struggle in South Africa, where young Liberians were quite heavily involved in raising consciousness about those issues. I also think, genuinely so, but also as a vehicle to discuss, you might disagree with me, I don't know, but people used some of that opportunity to have organizations and discussions and debates about South Africa in order to raise some human rights and other issues, political issues that were not okay to discuss publicly. And those expectations were raised within the country and outside the country at the same time that our recession led to some severe economic conditions. And all those things set the stage for some of the later events. I think I'll stop there.
I think it's a logical sequence. Having given the historical synopsis, we have to look at the legal atmosphere within which the process of governance was taking place. It's already been stated that the relationship was unequal. The settlers being considering themselves the lords of the land, and the indigenous being subservient to the rule of the settlers. In 1847, Liberia gained independence and came up with a constitution, which was incidentally, Massachusetts now, drafted by a professor from Harvard Law School, Seymour Greenleaf. Drafted a very beautiful document that, in fact, contained the provisions of human rights that were not contained in the American Constitution. So as a legal framework for the governance of Liberia, it was a beautiful document. It contained the best provisions on Bill of Rights. It stated that all Liberians were equal before the law, that all Liberians were entitled to certain inherent and inalienable rights, that no one could be denied life, liberty, property, and the pursuit of happiness except by due process of law. That constitution stated that the constitution of Liberia was the law of the land, was the organic law, was superior to any law, any custom, any regulation. That the Supreme Court was the highest interpreter of the law, and that its power of judicial review was respected and was superior. These are the same things that are stated in the American Constitution. That power is inherent in the people. They are the source of power, and it is for their happiness that the government takes place, and that they can alter their government through regular elections. These beautiful legal principles contained in the Constitution were not, as the Constitution stated, equally applied to all the citizens of Liberia. First, when the Constitution stated that we, the people of Liberia, in the governing process, there was a dichotomy to the extent that we, the people, meant the privileged few from the settler class. We, the people, did not cover the indigenous Liberians to the extent that they were not part of the legislature, they were not represented in the legislature. They did not have the right to vote until 1946. Imagine Liberia gained independence in 1847. The first time indigenous Liberians were allowed to vote was in 1946, and that was only male indigenous Liberians. It was in 1948 that women were allowed to vote. So even with that legal framework, and it did not consider all Liberians as equal under the Constitution, a very beautiful document, as I said, written by a legal luminary from Harvard. The indigenous were virtually excluded. If you even read some of the statutes, when they went to the Constitutional Assembly, there was revision, and there were things added like the immigrants, when an immigrant comes, a male immigrant is entitled to one town lot and 10 acres of land. If he comes with a wife, he has one town lot and 20 acres of land. They may not get more than 25. That same privilege was not given to indigenous Liberians. This was in the Constitution. So a lack of participation, at least not even legally considered, in the process of governance planted a seed for where we are today. So in 1946, Tubman was a revolutionary in terms of what had happened before him. He said the natives are allowed to vote. This is your government too. So in 1950, Detour and others decided that voting is not, we will not just come to vote. We will take upon ourselves that the right to vote also means the right to be voted for. So they formed a political party and decided to contest election. When they formed the political party, the process was that you file your articles of incorporation with the appropriate commissioner. When he approves it, then you can register your party. The article of incorporation stayed 3 months with the appropriate commissioner. He could not probate the articles of incorporation. They wrote the president. He didn't listen. There was no reply from them, from the president. So they wrote President Eisenhower of the United States, wrote the Queen of Britain, wrote the United Nations, saying that as Liberians, their rights to participate in public affairs was being restrained by the government of Liberia. Immediately, they were arrested and charged with sedition. They were charged on the legal theory that, in fact, on the political theory, not even legal, that they were inviting foreign states to interfere in the internal affairs of Liberia. And that was a violation of the law. That case was won by the government, as several sedition cases and treason cases have been won by the government. So from 1950, Honor Tubman, who had given the right to vote to the indigenous and was seen as a man promoting unity and unification of Liberia, he, in fact, planted a seed of political brutality in Liberia. Because from the Detour case came the William David Comer case, where a fellow settler was challenging the undemocratic nature of governance in Liberia. He and his son were brutally killed. If you watch the Liberia American Stepchild, you will hear the story from his daughter. From there on up to 1971, in fact, also during Tubman's period, although he was seen as promoting unity and bringing the indigenous people, creating few positions in the legislature for the indigenous people, he brought in something called the PRO, the Public Relations Officer. These were spies in every segment of Liberia, every village, every hamlet, to find out who was planning something against the government. And they were paid. The PRO was the source of several cases that came afterwards. The Fumbler case that involved some indigenous educated and political leaders who, just by the way they behaved among the Liberian people, were being feared for being possible alternative leaders, were arrested and charged with treason. That trial was something else. That was one of the trials that government won again. Then in the 60s, I mean, even though we had a legal framework that was just like the legal framework that governs Liberia, in practice, there were all kinds of ways or measures taken to avoid the enjoyment of the benefits of the Constitution. The Constitution allowed for freedom of expression. But look at the case of Cassell. Aboyeme Cassell had been Attorney General, and he had retired, and he went to Nigeria and presented a paper at a forum organized by the International Commission of Jurists. And he was critical about the Liberian judiciary and the lack of justice. On his return, the Supreme Court Chief Justice also attended that program. It was in Nigeria. He was arrested. He was charged with treason. I mean, charged with contempt of court. But it took a form of treason because at the end of it, he was disbarred from practicing law. And some of the amicus curiae, the friends of the court, who were asked to represent the court and to say what the law is, who did not conform to what the court wanted, were themselves suspended. So the governing process was different from what the Constitution provided. So under Tubman, it looked like there was relief. I mean, Talbot, it looked like there was relief. In 1971, when Tubman went to Bangui, on his first trip going to his farm, he said, I cannot govern a group of people that I cannot listen to. The PRO is hereby dissolved, and the Liberian people will speak their mind. So he gave a lot of hope. That's Talbot. But even he had a control on the political process. There was not free and fair elections under Talbot. The standard bearer of the Tory party decided virtually who went in the House of Representatives and who became what. So he was opening up, but he was not prepared to part from the old tradition. And I think that's where he was caught, because he gave a lot of hope that things were about to change and that Liberia would be governed based upon the rule of law. And as the, you know, but when it came time to make key fundamental decisions, he did not part from the tradition. Yeah. He did not part from the tradition. So time to elect, to get his vice president, he told everyone that the vice president will come from the indigenous segment, Jackson Doe. When it came closer to make that decision, he said he had a vision that it would be someone else and not Jackson Doe. And they did not go through the legal process of selecting a vice president to replace one that had died. Then, so he was overthrown because of all this political agitation using the South Africa case. I was part of that. The movement for justice in Africa was actually a movement for justice in Liberia. But, you know, we use the South African case, which was similar to our case, to conscientize people about our cause. 1980, the coup took place, and rule of law actually had its demise. That's when the death of rule of law came, because decree number two of the PRC, the People's Redemption Council, decree number one was no one should take order from any officer, no enlisted man should take order from any officer, because those who carried on the coup were enlisted men. The second decree was this Constitution of Liberia is hereby suspended, and all legislative and executive power are now reserved in the People's Redemption Council. And from hence, for they will now give, the People's Redemption Council will govern this country by decrees. That was the death of rule of law. And rule of law has not resurrected since. I will stop there.
Thank you. Now we'll hear from Madam Perry.
Well, I want to say here, ladies and gentlemen, it's a great pleasure for me tonight to be a part of this very important panel discussion, which focuses on the theme, Rebuilding Liberia's Historical Background. I'm therefore very grateful to the African Studies Center and African Presidential Archives and Research Center for organizing this forum, which affords a unique opportunity to exchange frank views on the historical background of the Civil War in Liberia. I particularly thank my distinguished colleagues on the panel for their brilliant and scholarly presentations. I sincerely believe that the first step to the solving of any problem is to acknowledge that it exists. In the first place, and that this panel has done well tonight, is to agree that Liberia has in fact been burdened with political, social, economic, religious, and other problems that have contributed to the civil nightmare in our country. I mean, it has lasted for about 14 years. Unfortunately, acknowledging, identifying, and talking about problems are not all that there is to solving problems. We can't solve all. Liberia has a long history of national and international conferences, panel discussions, symposia, etc., centered around talking about issues and problems that affect the country. Volumes have also been written concerning them. regrettably, very little or nothing has been done to implement the suggestions or recommendations that have usually been put forward for consideration. This is partly due to the fact that the wealth of information and counsel that these expertly done papers contain never really reach the policymakers and central figures of the government machinery back in Liberia. May I therefore recommend to this panel and to the African Studies Center that efforts to be made or compile the relevant findings and recommendations of these discussions regarding the situation in Liberia with an eye to submitting them to any subsequent national conference on the future of Liberia and to the United Nations. I want to say thank you. We hope to meet again.
Her Excellency Ruth Sandeau Perry, former interim president of Liberia and current president in residence at the African Presidential Archives and Research Center. Earlier, we heard from Counselor Tiwan Gonglo, a Liberian human rights lawyer, Dr. Joe Sullivan, the executive director of the Cambridge Public Schools Office of Curriculum Development, Dr. John Gay, who's written and studied extensively in Africa and lived and worked in Liberia in the 1960s, and Dr. Patrick Sion, former president of the University of Liberia. Tonight's discussion was entitled Rebuilding Liberia and was the first of three being presented by Boston University's African Studies Center and the African Presidential Archives and Research Center. For a CD or cassette of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. That's 1-800-909-9287. CDs and cassettes are $15 and includes shipping and handling. Tonight's program was produced by Matt Largy and Tim Skog with help from Matt Odette. Our web producer is Angel Cazelli. I'm Gina Cervetti. Thanks for joining us.